On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in the pre-election boil with everything at stake, and it showed this week. Policy, pronouncements, campaign ads, and tempers popping off in all directions, some old, some new, some ugly. Under fire from miserable poll numbers, Stay the Course took a hike in Washington. In Baghdad, the U.S. ambassador announced agreement on a timeline. Iraq's own leader said, no way. The top U.S. general said 12 to 18 months to hand over. Donald Rumsfeld told deadline seekers to just back off. A campaign ad dives to sex and race. Madonna sings for a baby. Up next, On Point, a week in the news. From bloody Iraq to Michael J. Fox, gay marriage, hot polls, and more. Joining me now from Washington is Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and blogger for the National Review Online. Her column today is headlined, 13 Reasons to Vote Republican on November 7th. Mona, I guess we know where you stand. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, I thought I'd keep it a mystery.
Right. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mona.
We will be joined in just a few minutes by Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine as well. But Mona, let me come straight to you. What's your top story this week?
Well, Madonna's child? No.
Maybe not.
That's actually
Maybe not.
The top story is whether the election that is coming up on November 7th will be decided on matters of importance, namely where we stand in the war on terror and how we best secure our future, or whether it will be bogged down in a lot of trivialities like people's sex lives and perceptions of corruption and mudslinging and so on.
David Brooks, New York Times columnist, writes this week, we're about to enter one of those periods without a dominant ideology. This election will mark the end of conservative dominance. This election is a period, not a comma in political history. What do you say to that, Mona?
Well, I read that piece, and it was very interesting. I don't quite agree, though, because I think that in light of the international situation, in light of the fact that what you are seeing worldwide is a challenge to the fundamentals of Western civilization. For example, Europe, as we have known it, is on the verge of potential collapse and Islamicization through a combination of the lack of European, the low European birth rate, the high Muslim birth rate within Europe, and the collapse of the civilizational confidence, if you will, of the Europeans. Those things are combining to create a world in which, in the very near future, we may be looking at an Islamicized Europe. That would.
So, in a funny way, you're coming back to Madonna and child of a different stripe here. But what about the war that's sitting right in front of us, Mona? The president saying a lot this week, all kinds of really difficult to follow back and forth between U.S. officials and Maliki and the Secretary of Defense. What do you make of what's going on in Iraq?
Well, I have always been a more troops person. I think that Colin Powell turns out to have been right when he argued that massive force would be the only way to go. And I'm sorry that advice wasn't taken. There are some of us who've been urging more troops now for several years. That much having been said, I think that the outright cheerleading for defeat that I see on the part of some Democrats is just terrible and doesn't advance our interests or the interests of a peaceful resolution in Iraq. Certainly, if we were to depart now, which is the recommendation of many Democrats and many liberals, it would be a catastrophic event for the United States and I believe also for the world. The terrorists who are convinced that they chased the Soviets out of Afghanistan, that they chased us out of Lebanon, that they chased Israel out of Gaza, that they chased us out of Somalia and so on, that all it takes is a little push and we collapse, will have that view completely ratified,
Mona,
if we pull out of Iraq.
Let me ask you, I think you had lunch this week with Dick Cheney, you and a clutch of conservative columnists. Is that the Dick Cheney line, Democrats cheerleading for defeat?
No. No, he absolutely didn't say that. I asked him to predict what would happen in the war in Iraq if Democrats took majorities in both houses, and he declined to speculate. I feel strongly that you know, it's fine to argue about tactics. It's fine to say, look, this doesn't seem to be working. We need to try something else. But I just despair of the Democrats' tendency to say, we've lost, it's hopeless, let's pull out.
I've got to say, I'm hearing very sober assessments right across the political spectrum on the show. Let's listen for a moment to what the president has had to say this week. Wednesday, his press conference, he signaled the new mantra for Iraq is flexibility.
As the enemy changes, we change. War is not this war and other wars. You know, they're not static. They're dynamic events, and we must adjust to meet those events, and we are.
Jack Beatty, Democrats cheerleading for defeat, the president adjusting to win?
What the president is doing is, I think, as Prime Minister Maliki has said, is playing politics. He's trying to make people think that he's willing to change on Iraq. And maybe he is after the election when Jim Baker, when his commission gives him the report. But, you know, changing terminology isn't going to do it. I mean, now a near majority of Americans, this really surprised me in a recent poll, think we are losing in Iraq. 63% want timetable to get out of Iraq, according to the latest Gallup poll. People are getting it that we are in the middle of a civil war. Maliki, our guy, is, for whom we have sacrificed 20,000 wounded, nearly 3,000 dead, $300 billion. What is he saying? I don't have any truck with timetables or benchmarks. Oh no! Is he going to take on the Shiite militia? Well, no. They're his supporters. We're being taken by this guy, and Bush is saying, well, of course we can't insist on anything from him. He's a sovereign government. Our dead can't make us insist. Our money can't make us insist. What do we elect a president for if not to stand up for our own interests?
Let's hear the president again this week in his press conference expressing support but also frustration.
We're pressing Iraq's leaders to take bold measures to save their country. We're making it clear that America's patience is not unlimited. Yet we also understand the difficult challenges Iraq's leaders face. And we will not put more pressure on the Iraqi government than it can bear.
Not more than they can bear, but what a back and forth this week. It's a huge on the election front, as all the polls show, but it's not the only thing out there. Jack, what's your top headline, top story of the week?
Well, the election. We've had some prognostications from the people who watch this professionally. Charlie Cook says this is a 4.5 on a 5-point scale of hurricanes. Stu Rothenberg of the Rothenberg Report says that the numbers suggest a truly historic tidal wave for the Democrats. The metrics in the last tidal wave, of course, was the Republicans in 94. And you compare them. Wrong direction in 94, 48%. Now 61. President Clinton's approval rate, 94, 48. Now Bush, 38. Disdain for Congress, 67%, 1994, now 75%. The generic ballot question, which party do you want? Republicans were up 10 then. Democrats are up 15 now.
Mona Charon, very stormy weather out there. The Republicans, the White House went out on the lawn in a big tent this week with lots of radio people. Karl Rove, we heard him and many others saying, no, we're going to pull this out. We've got the machinery. We've got the base support. How do you see what's happening here, Mona?
Well, it may be a Democratic blowout, but I don't think it's going to be on the scale of 1994. For this reason, the Republicans in 1994 offered a vision, offered a promise of what they would do if they were given power. The Democrats are really just the default mode for expressing dissatisfaction for the Republicans. That is for the voters to express their dissatisfaction. The Democrats really don't have a plan. The Democrats don't have any better idea about how to govern the country or handle international affairs. It's really just a protest vote, as I see it. And that doesn't mean that the Democrats may not be the beneficiaries and may not take over, say, one house. But I don't think that in light of the weakness of the Democratic position that it's likely to be this huge tsunami.
Pete DuPont, no mean Republican, says this week in politics, as in others' jobs, there is a price to pay for poor performance. He's pointing at the GOP with that. Do you think that price will be paid?
To a degree, yes. And some of that is deserved and some of it isn't. Certainly the arrogance of power, the earmarks, the corruption, those things Republicans deserve to pay a price for. Of course, there's an irony there because the people who were guilty of that are gone. And those who were not themselves transgressors may be paying a price with their seats for the bad behavior of others. But that's the way it sometimes happens in politics.
We're looking at a week in the news, from Iraq to attack ads to panic and fever on the campaign trail. What's your top story this week? Here's the Michael J. Fox ad. Of course, he has Parkinson's disease. His body shakes with tremors in this television ad as he appeals to voters to vote for Democrats who support expanding stem cell research. Here's an ad for Claire McCaskill of Missouri.
As you might know, I care deeply about stem cell research. In Missouri, you can elect Claire McCaskill, who shares my hope for cures. Unfortunately, Senator Jim Talent opposes expanding stem cell research. Senator Talent even wanted to criminalize the science that gives us a chance for hope. They say all politics is local, but it's not always the case. What you do in Missouri matters to millions of Americans, Americans like me.
And then came Rush Limbaugh saying he was faking, then Rush Limbaugh apologizing. What do we make of all this, Mona Charon? Michael J. Fox, very well-known Parkinson's sufferer in the middle of a big political brouhaha this week.
Well, I think it's within his right to take sides politically based on his illness and his passionate desire for stem cell research. But I have to make a few points. One, what he said about Jim Talent wasn't true. Talent did not want to criminalize research. He simply wants to ban human cloning, which, by the way, the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives completely agree with. Two, the issue of stem cells has been embryonic stem cell research has been so exaggerated and so hyped. No one knows whether the science will bring cures, and there's been a tremendous amount of misinformation out there, you know, that Christopher Reeve would get up and walk and so on based on this science, and no one knows that for sure. And finally, I would say that those of us who take a different point of view about this are no less desirous than Michael J. Fox for a cure. I have someone in my family very close to me who has juvenile diabetes. Mm. It's of great import that we find a cure. On the other hand, there have to be certain moral guidelines that we observe as civilized human beings. And one of those, it seems to me, is that you never use one human being for the benefit of another. That each person has to be regarded as having worth and value in and of his or herself.
Mona, I didn't hear criminalization in that ad, and the human cloning thing is tricky.
Criminalize the science, he said. Criminalize the science.
Right, but there's the issue of embryonic cloning. Some people equate that with sort of, you know, making babies in egg cartons, but there's really something quite different that scientists are talking about. They're saying if we can't have embryonic cloning, it's really hard to get our hands around the possibility in stem cell research. Jack, you listening to this one as well, and the rush come on?
Well, it's interesting. There was a poll done by the HCD Research of 955 Americans. What were the reaction to this ad? Support for stem cell increase went up from 78% to 83%. Republicans who indicated they were voting for a Republican candidate decreased by 10% after viewing the ad. Independents planning to vote for Democrats increased by 10%. Among party affiliation, 93% of Democrats, 57% of Republicans, and 78% of independents indicated the ad was, quote, extremely believable or believable. Meanwhile, we have that ghoul stuffing the Viagra down his throat, Rush Limbaugh. Just indicating what kind of he is with that performance.
I want to bring Richard Wolff into our conversation from Newsweek. He joins us from Washington right now. Richard, I know you've been rushing Six Ways to Sunday down there. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Look out on this week, Richard. We began to talk about Iraq. We've been looking at stem cells and one very tight race in Missouri there, Jim Talent and Claire McCaskill. What's your top story of the week, Richard?
Well, my top story was really affected by the president's news conference, a really extraordinary thing that we'd have two news conferences in the space of a month. And, you know, it shows the deep concern in the White House about the way this election is going, and especially about Iraq. We polled at Newsweek just after the Foley scandal erupted, and the Democrats looked strong on every issue. Over the last 2 weeks, we polled again just last week, Republicans have closed the gap on every issue except one, and that is, surprise, surprise, Iraq. So this election was supposed to be a case where Iraq was the key card for Republicans. It would put Democrats on the defensive with the slogan cut and run. And what we saw this week from the president, and you see with Republican candidates across the country, is such a deep concern about Iraq that it may well take down the majorities in the House and the Senate.
Richard, I have to say I'm just plain confused at the end of this week about U.S. policy and the U.S. push here. Clearly a step away from the language of stay the course, which was the big drumbeat for a long time. But then we had the ambassador and the top U.S. general coming out and saying they're on track to get a timeline, agreement to have a timeline from the Iraqi government. Maliki saying no. Secretary Rumsfeld saying just back off and all this talk about timelines. Is there disarray here, or is it just the way we're hearing it filtered through? How do you look at it?
Well, a disarray is that the timelines don't match the reality, or even the policy doesn't match the reality, specifically about the confidence they express in the political track, i.e. the new government, the not-so-new government of Prime Minister al-Maliki, and also the security track. The training figures just haven't materialized in terms of better security on the ground. I don't think what you're seeing this week represents any change in policy, because there are no significant shifts out there. There are no good policy options out there. But it is a change in rhetoric, and the rhetoric, the politics of Iraq has worked very effectively for Republicans until now. What you're seeing instead of message discipline is this array of slogans and catchphrases that don't really mean a whole lot. People are confused. But remember, a benchmark isn't a benchmark. A timeline isn't a timeline unless there are consequences for failing to meet those benchmarks. And the administration has made it very clear that they may speak about benchmarks, but there's no real consequence for the Iraqis if they don't meet them.
The president was asked about accountability and success or failure in Iraq. And let me just hear for a moment, Mona, Richard. Here's the president talking about exactly that issue.
You're asking about accountability. That's rest right here. That's what the 2004 campaign was about. People are unhappy about it. Look right to the president.
Mona, I want to hear from you. But Richard, first, on the president, you were observing just his body language this week. Pretty tough there in the press conference.
Yeah, I thought he looked incredibly tired. I've covered him since 99, 2000, when he actually looked young for his age. One thing you notice really up front, right there at the press conference, especially this week, he looks much older than he has at any stage. His eyes looked scored and tired. And, you know, he may express confidence in public about winning, as he did just this week in the East Room. But I have to say, his face tells a different story. This is a war that is draining him emotionally and politically, too. And it shows.
Mona, what about it? There's the president looking drained. There are messages kind of in a spaghetti pile by the end of this week. How do you look at it?
Well, I'd like us, if we could, to step back from Bush and how he's handling it and look at the situation that we find ourselves in as a country.
Well, we've tried to Iraq, with Khalilzad, with General Casey, with Rumsfeld, with Bush. I mean, they're all talking about it. We're trying to follow.
Well, but here's the thing. What they are trying to convey and what I think is useful to focus on is that it's a delicate situation and that we really don't want to be in a position where we hand Iran a victory. And that would be what would happen if a civil war broke out, and the Shiites would be likely to win it, and then you would have an arm of the Islamic Republic in Iraq instead of a free, independent nation.
But many observers say that's exactly where we've come already under this administration, that that's the stark reality behind all the language.
No. We're definitely not there. And you're right, it may get there. It very well could. But that's what we're seeking to avoid. They are hoping that Maliki and the security forces, by the way, the development of the army The Iraqi army has gone quite well. It's the development of the police and the training of the police that has not gone so well.
And yet, when we asked for 6 battalions to help secure Baghdad, only 2 showed up. Still, the others haven't come. It's tough out there. Let me take a call from Fort Drum, New York. Jeremiah is on the line. Hi, Jeremiah. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just actually had a really quick... I'm hearing a lot about the either we have the cut or run, or we have the stay the course, and they're kind of taglines that they're now trying to turn away from the cut and run thing. But I'm wondering, you know, what about the focus on, you know, we all want to get to a good conclusion for this.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we focus on maybe lowering costs and maybe, you know, less civilians? I mean, the civilians are making over $100,000 a year out there.
Jeremiah, I'm reading here on my screen that you just came back from some kind of service in Iraq this summer. What were you doing there? What did you see?
I spent time in Baghdad, Iraq, with 187.
Is that decipher that for us, officer?
The one thing that I want to say though is there's so many civilians. Our actual chow hall, we are well equipped to run the chow hall to feed the soldiers and whatnot. But they have civilians who have contracted that out. They're making big money over there to do jobs that have the soldiers sitting on their butts.
So you were U.S. Army. What was your role, Jeremiah?
I'm actually an Army a mechanic.
And so you're looking at the machinery coming back in from the field pretty beat up?
What we like to do is see something come in and then leave that same day to just kind of make a statement.
Wow, that's great.
How is the morale?
That's the spirit soldier. Yeah, you hear that question about morale, Jeremiah?
I actually wanted to also ask about what the UN, we're all saying America, 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 would like to get, why don't we get the backing of everyone else? I know how they did the last scare that we had. It was all UN ran. Why can't we get UN support on this?
Jeremiah, we'll ask about that as well, but Mona's asking you, how did you find morale among U.S. troops during your year there?
It's all one-on-one basis. A lot of the soldiers, you know, they take it their own way, and we all had a thing to do, and we went out there and did the best that we could.
Jeremiah, thanks for your call and your question. Jack Beatty, a big finger pointed there at the cost, and Jeremiah says, we got a lot of high-paid civilians helping drive up the cost of this thing. Could we crank that down a little bit?
Yeah, a report from one of the inspector generals this week on the overhead, partly because of the amount of money that has to be spent on protection, but partly for other reasons, the overhead on many of these projects, overhead ranging as high, this is on a Halliburton project, as 55%. There's a lot of money being made for just keeping stuff there and not doing anything. And that's one of the things that the public expects the Democrats will do in the next Congress, conduct major investigations of the Bush administration, something like, and just barely, 51% favor that. But they expect the Democrats to do that, and I think they will do it.
Richard Wolf, here's Jeremiah. He's paid with boots on the ground and time in Iraq, and he says, isn't there a middle path here between stay the course and cut and run? And what about getting the UN involved, cranking down the U.S. presence a little bit? What's the conversation in Washington that you're hearing?
Well, there's a lot of focus on what Jim Baker, former Secretary of State and a longtime Bush family friend, is going to come up with. And the speculation really focuses on an attempt to bring in a sort of regional conference, other players. The problem with this is twofold. First of all, the key players in the region are actually hostile to the administration, the Bush administration, and the Bush administration is hostile to them. That's Syria and Iran. And secondly, the United Nations and the international community has been burned many times by this administration on Iraq, and they're reluctant to go back in, especially, again, for this administration. There's a lot of politics, and while some countries have softened their attitude, places like Germany with a new chancellor, those countries still have a sort of a political dynamic, which means that Iraq remains very unpopular. Tony Blair in Britain is being pushed out early, almost entirely because of Iraq. And the focus of those friendly countries, the friendly allies, if you will, is really Afghanistan, where the battle is also very tough. So there is a problem in pulling other countries in, as admirable and as desirable as it would be. And nobody doubts that it would be desirable to have greater international cooperation.
And those problems just surging back into American politics. Mona, yes.
May I just interject? you know, to say that Syria and Iran are hostile to the Bush administration, you know, severely understates the case. They are profoundly and deeply hostile to the United States.
And yet we had James Baker on this show saying sometimes you've got to talk to your enemies. You say no?
Well, I say that I cannot imagine what good would come of that. I think that the Iranians are hoping that we will hand them a victory, and I think that's a very dangerous outcome.
I mean, we haven't talked to Iran, and we've got the news you heard at the top of the hour. They're enriching more uranium now,
This is the argument that was made by Democrats about North Korea, and throughout the Clinton administration, we did nothing but talk with Yasser Arafat, who visited the White House in the Clinton years more than any other foreign leader. We talked with North Korea. How well did that work out?
You think we're better off now than we were at the end of the Clinton administration on both of those fronts? If you look at Israel, if you look at North Korea, I mean, they've got their testing.
Absolutely. We are paying the price, though, for what was done then in some respects.
Wow, 6 years later, you're still pinning it there. It's amazing.
No, in the case of North Korea, I certainly do say so, because those were the years when it could have been headed off. Unfortunately, it wasn't.
Let's take a call from Ellen in Halifax, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Many of my points have been made already, but I do see Iraq as the prism through which we have to see any kind of shift of leadership party-wise in our country. And I find it very rich that the Republicans create the mess that we're in now in Iraq and the Middle East in general, and then when things go badly, throw up their hands and say, well, do you have a better option? What's your plan? What's your specific plan?
But do you have confidence, Ellen, that the Democrats could handle it better or not?
I have confidence that the rest of the country understands that we have a two-party system and that the Democrats definitely believe in diplomacy, which I don't really feel that the present administration does have faith in. We believe in the U.N. We support the U.N. There are basic fundamental values that are American that I think are much better represented by the Democratic Party, and we don't have to be more, we really and honestly don't have to be more specific than just say our policy will be to reestablish the United States as a beacon of justice and peace throughout the world.
Ellen, we hear you holding the torch there. Richard, I heard you trying to come in just before Ellen's call.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple of things. Mona says that Iran is hostile to the United States. In fact, the most reliable public opinion surveys we've seen out of Iran suggest that it's one of the most pro-American countries
not the government.
Well, who are you talking about? Iran is a bifurcated country. It has a complex regime which doesn't hold to a single line. That's what actually makes negotiating with it extremely difficult.
We're looking at a week in the news this hour, from Iraq to attack ads, panic and fever on the campaign trail, Madonna's adoption in Africa or her try there. Mona Charon is with us, syndicated columnist with the National Review Online. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, is here. Jack Beattie is with us. Shock and awe and charges of racism in Tennessee this week. A campaign ad there put out by the Republican National Committee, paid for, shows a bare-shouldered woman saying that she met Harold, that is Harold Ford, Democratic African-American candidate for the U.S. Senate, at a Playboy party. He's black. The woman is white. Here we go.
I met Harold at the Playboy party.
I'd love to pay higher marriage taxes.
Canada can take care of North Korea. They're not busy.
So we took money from porn movie producers. I mean, who hasn't?
The Republican National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Harold, call me.
Call me. And then the ruckus over whether this was race baiting on a real old-fashioned scale. We'll talk about it. Let me get Gloria from Leslie, Michigan first. Hi, Gloria. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I have a comment, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I would like to direct this to Mona.
Okay.
Her comment about stem cell cloning, you know, human beings, the moral part of that, I think that's a fantastic idea. Maybe we could clone some politicians that are liars, thieves, that take away from the poor to give to the rich, and start wars. I think it's a wonderful idea.
So you're playing with us, Gloria. You want to clone some different politicians? We got it.
Clone me some honest politicians.
Well, wherever they're going to come from, let's get another call from Boston. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to follow up on that topic. I saw Michael J. Fox on the CBS Evening News last night, and a couple things struck me. First, it's pretty clear he wasn't faking his condition. he pointed out that he'd actually had a bit too much medication in his system mm-hmm. when that commercial was filmed, and that's why he was swaying. He also said that he'd campaigned for Arlen Specter, and so he isn't just anti-Republican. He's concerned about the issue. And Mona mentioned earlier that she never wants to use one human being for the benefit of another. So does that mean she's against all organ transplants?
Okay. Mona Charon?
Yeah, I'm against taking an organ from someone against their will for the benefit of another. Yes, a voluntary action is altruism. Forcing a person to do that against their will or without their consent is monstrous.
Mona, take us to the ads in Tennessee, a big brouhaha over what many interpreted as a kind of race-baiting stab at Harold Ford there,
and then
a big brouhaha about whether they were taken off or not. How'd you see it?
It was just standard political advertising. I'm driving down the street, and I hear the come on from NPR saying there's been a racist ad uncovered. I thought, well, let's hear it. What terrible ad was this? And then I found out what it was, and I thought, good Lord, you've got to really stretch to find racism there. I mean, nobody cares anymore about interracial couples or interracial sex or
anything. Is
that
right?
The whole point.
In Tennessee?
I don't think anybody. I think there's a fringe that might possibly, and they certainly don't represent any share of the electorate.
If they don't care, why run the ad? What do you think the point of it was?
Playboy. No, it wasn't. I cannot imagine that the race of the woman involved matters. It was just
they were
trying
to pin him. You think it was random? They just chose an actress at random.
Well, maybe they did and maybe they didn't, but it's so trivial, and there's been such a huge do made out of this.
Yeah.
And I don't like the ad. It's not the kind of thing I would do. If I were running for office, I would do only serious policy-oriented advertising. But let's face it, there's lowbrow advertising on both sides this year. It's hardly limited to Republicans.
Jack Beatty, does this define the bottom of that body of advertising? She looks naked. She says, call me with a wink. What's going on?
Well, I think Carol Ford had an insouciant and charming response to this. He said, heck, this is how desperate they are, the thing that accused me of liking girls. But, of course, in the South, that's charged, that's loaded imagery. You know, a study of 38...
You're 50 years out of date, Jack.
Then why are they using it, Mona?
A study of 3,800 lynchings between 1880 and about 1950 found that almost in all cases, one way or another, sex with a white woman or winking
right.
at a white woman.
You're 50 years out of date.
That these things were part of the whole mentality. And this ad scratches that blood-soaked chapter in American history.
Richard Wolf, referee for us a little bit here. Richard, you've been down in Tennessee recently. Bring us some straight reporting from the scene.
Of Karl Rove.
Yeah.
Let me say, I was down in Tennessee. I also happened to have written a piece about Scott Howell, who's the guy who taped this ad, who produced this ad.
So what can you tell us?
Let me tell you, everything in Tennessee has a racial tinge to it. After all, you have an African-American candidate running statewide. So there is a racial overtone to everything. In fact, Scott Howell produced a previous ad which had a hip-hop backing to it. Now, was that racist? No. Was it intentional? Everything in these ads is meticulously planned. Having said that, I don't think this ad is the most egregious form of racism you're going to find in Tennessee, or even a mild version. What really matters, what makes it such a powerful ad is actually the humor involved. And the problem for Ford, yes, he came up with a response 3 days later, but his initial response was actually to panic a little bit. He crashed the press conference from his rival candidate, Bob Corker, the Republican running down there. He's tried to pass his whole position on the Playboy party. He said he didn't go to a Playboy mansion. Well, this party was actually at the Super Bowl. He could have dealt with this in a humorous way, in a lighthearted way, and tried to divert the conversation immediately. But it took him several days to find his footing on it, and I think that's not a good sign for him as a candidate or a campaign. Yes, the ad was tacky, and that's actually its biggest fault in Tennessee, but the humor was very effective, and the racial side to it, like I say, I mean, there are other signals they can send about race in this election, and they are, by just simply mentioning that Ford comes from a family that's big in Memphis. That's all they need to say. People know he's African-American. He's succeeding in spite of that. The Playboy thing, the pornography, producer cash donations he's been getting, those are bigger problems for him, and he hasn't found an effective way to deal with it so far.
Let me take a call from Windsor, Connecticut. Evans on the line. Hi, Evan. You're on the air.
Hi, Hi, thank you. I wanted to address my comments directly to Mona. I'm an African-American Republican, longtime Republican. I've been involved in two national presidential campaigns on the national level and very much involved. And I'd like to say that that ad was in very poor taste. It did have racial under and overtones. That's a fact. We can talk about today things are different. Today things are different because of the institutional message that racism, the messages from racism. Please do not be naive to think because you see interracial couples today, racism is not alive and well. It's a trigger. It was a trigger ad. It was done to send a subversive message. It was inappropriate. I did not agree with Ken Melman, who I do know, when he says there's nothing wrong with that ad.
And head of the Republican National Committee, and it supposedly has kept running quite a while after we're told it was going to come down even.
Yeah, I mean, if you even have the Republican candidate asking for it to come down, even he had the sense to know. The bottom line, it was inappropriate. My brother's married to a white woman from Texas, and he's been married to her for quite some time, and he experiences the very same type of undertones that exist. So until you've lived it, you cannot necessarily make a qualified comment, Mona.
Richard Wolff, is there enough in this to tip this election at the margins? How close is it? What impact do you think the ad could have?
Close. It's very close. The most recent polls give Corker a 2-3 point lead. You know, people don't poll honestly about questions of race like this. And I do think the harder problem for Harold Ford is that it got under his skin and he showed it. Mm. And
I think the bigger problem is that he did take money from a pornographer and that he did attend this Playboy party. And that doesn't reflect well on him in a conservative state.
But I've seen huge Republican parties at Playboy clubs around. I mean, that's not exactly a one party deal or a Herald deal.
Well, if a Republican is caught behaving in a way that doesn't reflect well on him and on him as a representative of family values, we've seen what happens to him.
Yep. Remember, Harold Ford has taped ads in churches. I mean, he has laid on his religion and his religious faith, which I take totally sincerely, but he has made this a principal part of his campaign, and he's been running for some time. He went to this Playboy party in 2005, which wasn't that long ago, and I think you have to question a little bit of his judgment there.
Yeah, a little church and a little skin there. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Lon is on the air. Hi, Lon.
Hi, this is Lori from Tennessee.
Lori, excuse me. Hi, Lori.
That's okay. Hi.
I can't read today.
I saw the ad only on Wednesday because I was out of town, and then I saw Larry King Wednesday night when they were stating that the ad had been taken off, which clearly, as of late that afternoon, it had not.
Mm-hmm.
I am white. I did not even think about anything racial in terms of when I saw the ad. All I thought was that it was incredibly sleazy. And I also thought that for a party that aligns themselves with evangelical Christians, that they were really taking the low road.
Of course.
And I find it unnecessary.
Lori, we've got it. We appreciate your call from Nashville. Of course, as Richard says, Harold Ford has filmed plenty of himself in the church this year. I want to get to another subject here. There's so many. The big New Jersey Supreme Court ruling on same-sex couples saying they should have the same rights in a relationship as heterosexuals stopped short of saying if those rights include the right to marry. That decision will be left up to the state legislature in New Jersey. Matt Daniels, president of the Alliance for Marriage, said the ruling will boost conservative turnout on Election Day.
It will drive people to the polls in states where marriage referenda are on the ballot. To the extent that spills over into races, it could have an impact on the outcome of elections.
So there you are, saying it's going to bring out the conservatives. On the other side, we had same-sex couples who want to marry saying they won't be satisfied with civil unions.
It's something fundamentally different.
And less than.
We never got involved in this to get something that was less than marriage. It's about the dignity of our family. It's about Casey saying to his friends, my parents are married. They're not civil unioned.
Mona Charon, gay marriage seemed almost off the screen. Then here comes the New Jersey ruling. We've got just over a week before Election Day. Is this going to come back as an influential issue in this midterm race?
Well, it may remind some voters, some conservative voters, that part of the liberal project in America is to have social change through court mandates rather than through legislation. And there's terrific resentment about that on this and many other questions. There have been state referenda on gay marriage in, I think, 19 states now. They've all gone against it. And so, yes, there it is quite possible that some voters may be spurred to go to the polls because of this usurpation of power once again by a court.
Richard Wolff, what do you see? The GOP has come in quick on this and said, as Mona does here, look, this is the reason you need us to the base. Do you see this energizing, pulling it out?
No, I don't. And for one big reason, which is that actually Bush's own strategists and pollsters said that in 2004, as much as everybody thinks gay marriage drove people to drive their own base out, they found no evidence of that whatsoever. In states where gay marriage initiatives were on the ballot, they had no higher turnout than they did in states where it wasn't on the ballot. So they said that actually the driver, the big values question, was about the war and terrorism. It wasn't these social questions. You've got to remember that in the last 2 years, President Bush's standing among white evangelical voters, according to polls, is down 20 points. So you can see why they want to try to assert himself, why he wants to look better among those base voters. But it didn't prove effective in 2004. I don't think it will now.
Jack Beatty, the country inoculated at this point on gay marriage, does it have the same punch it did back when it was believed to have punch or not?
I don't know. I see in a recent poll voters do not expect the Democrats to push this. 38% don't expect that the Democrats will push this, and that it's not clearly identified with the Democrats. But, you know, I'm looking at a photograph in yesterday's Times of a couple holding hands, touching heads, their daughter sitting beside them. And I think that photograph in 150 years will be in the textbooks.
This is a gay
and
couple?
And Americans will say that we have moved ahead, that the majestic promise of the 14th Amendment, equal protection of the laws, that march from 1868 to today continues, and that this was a moment in American history when people moved ahead. And they'll also remember that one president in American history submitted, backed a constitutional amendment that would limit rights, and George Bush will not be remembered fondly for that.
Well, we'll see soon enough what the voters have to say now.
If the American people want that to happen, they can enact it through their legislatures, and what they have shown so far is that they want the exact opposite. So my point is, if that's the direction of the country and that's what the people choose, that's fine. But I don't think it is fair for courts to impose it, and I think it's undemocratic and highly dangerous.
Our time is very short. Let's cast our eye to Africa. Madonna took her adoption controversy there to Oprah. A material girl denied that she short-circuited the process to adopt 13-month-old David from the impoverished African nation Malawi.
If only my wealth and my position could have made things go faster. I assure you, it doesn't matter who you are or how much money you have, nothing goes fast in Africa.
Mona, you've got adoption in your own family. What'd you think of the whole Madonna situation here in Africa? A good heart doing the right thing? Something else? Jumping the queue?
Well, the only part of this story that disturbs me a little bit is whether or not, and this is not clear from the news reports, whether or not the boy's father understood what he was doing. In this country, before a child is available for adoption, you have to jump through about 20 hoops to make sure that both parents understand that they are relinquishing their rights. If the father really was unclear about what was happening, then that may be a problem. Obviously, it's wonderful to adopt a child from a poor country and give him or her a good life financially, but you have to make sure first that everybody is aware and everyone is on the same page about what the consequences of an adoption are, that he's giving up his parental rights.
Richard Wolff, a contentious time. Even this kind of gesture ends up in the middle of a big controversy.
It says something about Madonna's staying power as a star, I think, which surprises me. But also, look, people seem to be clueless about adoption. Money always changes hands when it comes to adoption. And in some cases, it becomes excessive. And Romania had to shut down, effectively, its whole adoption program because people were essentially selling their children. But money's always been a factor. And you know, I'm in a way surprised that people are shocked by it.
And there's a week from Baghdad to Madonna. The week ahead, wow, it could be something on the way to these midterm polls. High stakes here and high passions. We saw a lot of it this week. I want to thank each of you for being with us this hour. Mona Charon, syndicated columnist, blogger for the National Review Online. Mona, thanks very much for joining us this hour.
Pleasure.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, always good to have you. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.